Friends and family, we welcome you to Tabernacle Baptist Church in the heart of Richmond, Virginia's historic Fan District. If you're joining us tonight by way of our podcast, we want you to know that we are absolutely thrilled that you've joined us. We know some of you are listening to these things right after they come out, and others are listening 5 years from now, and regardless, we want you to know that we welcome you with open arms, and we consider you a part of the family. This is week number 9, I believe. 10. Wow, this is week number 10 in our dialogue about faith and sexuality. And last week we, under the good guidance of Reverend Kristen Koger, talked about children and sexuality. And tonight we will continue to climb the developmental scale and move on to adolescence and sexuality. And so we do welcome our podcasters. And then, of course, we welcome those of you that are here live this evening. We're a smaller group. We're getting into November, you can tell, but a mighty group. And so Dr. Art Wright has finally returned to the microphone. He was here every week for a long time, and we made him turn red in the face every week, and then we finally gave him a pretty good break, but he's back tonight. So he's a brave scholar, and we do welcome him back. So Dr. Wright, come and lead us.
I imagine I'll have plenty of opportunities to blush tonight. All right. I just want to say thank you to Kristen Koger for leading last week. She did a great job and set us up well for this week. So this week's topic, as Sterling said, is how to talk to your teenagers. Really, we'll say middle schoolers and high schoolers about sex and sexuality. And like Kristen, I found a lot of good information in Kate Ott's book, Sex and Faith. So I'll be following that a good chunk of tonight, but did pull in some other information as well. So let me start with a question to you all, just to get you thinking and talking. Why do you think it is that we're afraid to talk to our children and teenagers about sex and sexuality? Why do you suppose we have a lot of anxiety around this subject? What exactly is it that we're worried about? What's sort of the worst case scenario of talking to our kids about sex? So let me just throw this question out there to you. Whether you have teenagers, whether you had teenagers, whether you imagine having teenagers one day, or whether you were a teenager one day, what's the cause for concern?
They'll know more than we do.
They may already. They have the internet. Once they fully understand it, they might want to try it. Yes. Yeah. Often the reverse is the case. I'll probably talk about that a little bit tonight, but usually when youth are well-informed, they actually delay sexual activity. So it's actually the opposite from our fear. What else? Why are we afraid to talk to our kids about it?
They'll ask questions that we can't answer or uncomfortably.
Oh, yeah, good question. Comment. So they'll ask questions that we can't answer or don't feel comfortable asking. Or may ask questions that we don't want to answer. Dad or mom, when was the first time you had sex, right? And then we shift a little bit uncomfortably, all right? Anybody else? Reasons that we might be nervous to talk to our kids about this? We might think that we're not telling them the right thing, absolutely. Yeah, lots of good ideas. Lots of cause for concern. I hope that I can equip you well this evening to talk to teenagers about sex and sexuality. We're gonna start with a couple of true and false questions, but then I'm going to talk about how to talk to and what to talk to middle schoolers about. Then I'll move on to high schoolers. And then I have kind of like three pressing topics that I'm going to save for the end that I'm not going to tell you what they are because I don't want to make you nervous. All right. All right, so let's see how these true and false questions go. So what's changed since I was a kid? True or false? All teenagers are having sex, except mine. Right? True or false? Yeah, probably false, with a smiley face. Very few young teens engage in sexual intercourse, but statistics suggest by the time they're seniors in high school, over half will have engaged in sexual intercourse. All right? And teens aren't necessarily engaging in sexual behaviors earlier or more often than their parents' generation. One of the differences is, in the past, people usually had sex with the person they were going to get married to. because marriage was often a year or two after high school. Now marriage has been pushed back later and later, as late as 27 to 29 years old, as we saw a few weeks ago. And on average, in the U.S. today, young adults under the age of 24 have had two or three partners with whom they've had sexual intercourse. And I just want to say a quick word about statistics. They sure do vary from study to study. It's hard to get precise statistics. And of course, they're often politicized nowadays. So I try to cite my sources throughout. They're in the slideshow. If you're a podcast listener and you want to email me, I can send you my sources. But when I could, I tried to check statistics of various studies against each other to see where they corroborated. And many of them do come from Kate Ott's book. All right. True or false? There are more gay and lesbian teens than when I was in high school. Let's do show of hands. True? False. Okay. Looks like the falses are the majority. False, most likely. There aren't a lot of long-term studies on teens identifying as gay or lesbian. The difference nowadays is probably more teens are self-identifying and are coming out at younger ages. So there were probably gay and lesbian teens present in earlier generations. They just weren't self-identifying and coming out as such. And certainly we've seen cultural attitude shifting towards acceptance. So it's easier to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender in an open way in schools today. Of course, bullying continues to be a major issue for many LGBT teens. True or false? Kids don't date anymore. Yeah, depends on how you define dating. So I said false, ... and true. So how do you define dating? Many youth do typically have a significant other with whom their friends know that they're paired with. But in the past, here's part of the difference. Dating in high school was essentially a mating ritual where you decided if you wanted to marry the person or not. Dating nowadays is more often for companionship, learning to build relationships, falling in love, and fulfilling sexual desires. The end goal isn't necessarily marriage for dating relationships today. Of course, most or all of us have heard of this sort of hookup culture, and this does represent a sort of dramatic shift in dating rituals. Youth meeting up and pairing off to engage in various levels of sexual activity, typically with no strings attached, and no expectation for really caring about the other person. Although Kate Ott says, in practice, as you might imagine, it's often very emotionally messy and doesn't go quite so smoothly as folks think. There are hints that the pendulum is swinging back, however, there's certainly some evidence of a shift back towards the good parts of dating culture. So young adults and teens value time to get to know one another. We see that they still value deepening relationships over time, relationships that are exclusive from the outset, gradual addition of sexual behaviors to a relationship over time, and some sense that there's a desire to kind of like leave behind the bad parts of the dating culture, where practices that promote gender inequality or the idea that anyone you might date might be a potential lifelong partner. So yes, the hookup culture has been prevalent, but there may be a shift back in the other direction. All right, good job on those true-false questions. So we're going to talk about middle schoolers first and then high schoolers, what sort of things you need to talk to them or be talking to them about. And I'm not going to give you verbatim what you need to say, so you can't just play this podcast back for your teens and say, here, listen to what Art said on Wednesday night, unfortunately. But we do know sexuality education is ongoing. It's not a one-time high-stakes conversation that you have when they're 12 or 13 or 14. It's something that you're talking about over a lifetime. It's an ongoing thing. So we're going to talk about the middle school years first, roughly ages 11 to 13. And let me just ask briefly, you may or may not want to share, but what are some prominent feelings and memories that you remember from your experience of going through puberty? And are they primarily positive or negative? I'm seeing one shaking head. Not good. One person slammed the door a lot. Okay. Very awkward time, yes. A lot of middle schoolers feel very awkward. A lot of adults think they are very awkward. It's not imagined awkwardness, it is awkwardness.
Mom, why'd you let me wear those?
Yeah, why did mom or dad, why did you let me wear this during this stage of life? Well, let me just take a quick poll. Puberty, primarily positive experience? All right, a couple, three, four, good. Primarily negative experience. All right, maybe 10, 12, 15 or so folks. All right. So this is an age that we often refer to as the tweens. Middle schoolers are no longer children, but they're not yet teenagers. And they're going through a number of major transitions in this stage of life. We see many tweens or middle schoolers are staying home alone. They're increasingly focused on particular talents and interests. Friends are increasingly important, and family may be decreasingly important. And so there's this balance that you're seeking as a parent, a need to set clear boundaries for middle schoolers, yet also a need to grant some measure of independence in order for them to learn to develop healthy relationships and take personal responsibility for their behaviors. And of course, well, I don't have one, but I remember middle schoolers like to push against tests and push against or test rules and limits. And this is sort of their developmental role and how they test their decisions. So they're supposed to do that. So show them some grace as they struggle and as you struggle with that. All right. Middle schoolers will have diverse experiences of puberty and maturation. Some children will be physically mature and yet emotionally immature. So becoming they still have the minds of children, but, you know, transitioning to an adult body. Whereas some children will be mature relationally, but won't have yet hit puberty. Children, youth in middle school may begin to experience feelings of attraction and may begin to experiment with sexual activity, especially kissing and touching. Of course, plenty of anxiety comes with the approach of puberty. So when will it happen? How's it going to go? What will it look like or feel like for me? And you see kids often trying to measure themselves against this normal experience of puberty that actually doesn't really exist. Everyone's going to go through puberty a little bit differently. All right, so what is your role as a parent in this phase? Largely, it's this. One, help them know what to expect. Two, help them prepare for how to handle the changes that accompany puberty. Three, remind them that these changes are perfectly normal. Four, continue to show them love and acceptance, even when, for example, they have their first menstruation or wet dreams. And also, let them know that you're willing to have conversations and that they can ask questions about, you know, things that they don't understand or significant decisions that they may need to make. One thing I appreciated about my folks growing up is they said, you can ask us anything. No guilt, no consequence just for asking the question. We just want you to know that we're a safe place to ask questions. And I think that's a great model. All right. If you attempt to approach things like this as a parent, it may cut down on feelings of awkwardness, discomfort, and shame that many middle schoolers feel as they go through puberty. And it may, dare I hope, even promote feelings of awe and anticipation of puberty. You know, as I think about it, puberty in other cultures isn't always accompanied by fear and shame. In a lot of cultures, it's actually revered as a sort of coming of age, like finally you're a man or you're a woman and you can create life. And I don't think that's typical in our culture to have that sort of feeling. One more thing that I'll say before I talk about these things that are on the screen. Middle schoolers are often at the point where they think they know everything already, or they should know everything already. And so you may have to take the lead on sharing this information. You can't really expect that they're going to come to you asking questions. All right. So, all right. Fun words I have on the screen. Puberty, just very simply, the transition one's body makes in order to be able to reproduce or make a baby. You see development of secondary sex characteristics. I'll just go through a handful of these: hair under the arms and around external genitals, deepening of the voice, growth of penis and testicles, breast buds begin to grow, increased sweating, growth spurt and height. Just reading this list makes me anxious about remembering all the changes. I remember thinking, I don't want hair down there. So, thinking about hygiene, this is typically when children should start wearing deodorant and showering more often, and as a response to these physical changes. All right. Still thinking about, you know, your role as a parent and what you should prepare your children and youth for. By middle school, looking at the screen, children should have a complete understanding of menstruation, erections, and ejaculation. It's important for both boys and girls to have this information about all three of these because it can cut down on jokes and misinformation and teasing and a lack of gender awareness that many middle school children encounter. All right, so if you just have boy children, that doesn't mean you don't have to talk about menstruation. If you just have girl children, that doesn't mean you don't have to talk about erections or ejaculation. All right. Now, you may have covered this information from a biological perspective in elementary school, but now is actually the time to help prepare your children for. So, for example, menstruation, and I put the word menarche up here. Menarche is the age of first period. The average age in the U.S. That they undergo menarche is 12.5 years. I did look up that pronunciation. It is menarche. Before this time, you should probably introduce girls to tampons and pads, make sure they have access to them or know where to find them in the house or out in public when needed. And I thought this was an interesting suggestion from Ott. You may encourage them to keep a menstruation journal for, say, the first year that she has her period to help her recognize signs of the onset of menstruation. For example, headache, upset stomach, light spotting, and so forth. And something like this empowers them to get to know their bodies well, to take good care of their bodies, and might help them form a more positive self-image about their bodies rather than a shameful image. All right. How are we doing? Everybody okay? Good. I'm loose. All right. An erection is when muscles at the base of the penis contract and blood flow increases to the penis, causing it to swell and become erect. And actually, men, we were capable of doing this from birth or maybe even in utero. Babies get erections. Erections increase during puberty as boys begin to experience feelings of attraction and sexual desire. They can happen for no apparent reason, frustratingly enough. Erections are a bodily response. They're not easy to control, especially for middle school boys. And I speak as a former middle school boy myself. You know, so many middle school boys have this anxiety of standing in front of the class and getting a resurrection during, like, the spelling bee or something. What? we switched. Yeah, Sterling replaced the word resurrection for erection, I think, if I recall correctly, last Easter. On Mother's Day. Oh, good. Male children often become anxious about getting erections in front of class during a spelling bee or so forth. So I don't know, what do you do? Standing behind a podium sure helps. letting them know that it's, you know, a perfectly normal part of life. All right, and one last thing on this screen. Ejaculation, the word spermarchy refers to when sperm first develops in testes in response to the hormonal changes in the body. Average age for boys for this is 13.5 years. So boys need to be prepared for when an erection leads to ejaculation. And you might just explain, often for boys, the first ejaculation will occur as a wet dream at night. And it would be good to discuss with your child what to do with sheets and pajamas if and when this happens. And this is going to be what's most comfortable for your family. Are you going to do the laundry? Is he going to do the laundry? And so it would be good to just make sure he's comfortable with the plan and knows that this is a normal bodily function, okay? Attraction and sexual desire typically develop during this period too. Feelings of wanting to be close to someone or particular people. And so children need to know, our youth, attraction is a normal feeling in response to things that we find pleasing. It's important for children to know that we can decide how to respond to these attractions. So, for example, I can decide not to eat a whole pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream or binge watch the entire series of Breaking Bad in a week because I know that either would be unhealthy for me. So we get to decide how we respond to these feelings of attraction and sexual desire. Now, I will say, along these lines, it's normative in our culture and our society to say to children, you're a boy, you're going to grow up and like a girl. You're a girl, and you're going to grow up and like boys and get married to a boy and so forth. I think it would be wise if we did shift this a little bit and be honest with children and say, you know, some men are attracted to other men, some women are attracted to other women. Whatever our personal perspectives on same-sex relationships and marriage, I think this sort of information can protect our children from feelings of shame and confusion that often develops among lesbian and gay youth. So I think it's important to just let them know that attraction may occur for someone of the opposite sex or may occur for someone of the same sex. I think it's going to help them have a more positive self-image moving forward. All right. Many middle schoolers may engage in initial sexual behaviors if they begin dating. This may include behaviors like kissing or touching or holding hands. And to some degree, this is important and necessary for learning to build trust and to communicate in relationships. A small percentage, less than 10%, are going to engage in sexual intercourse. But I think given that some will, by middle school, youth need to know something about contraception and safer sex practices. And they're old enough to understand some sort of message like, this is the right way to keep you and your partner safe. You can show them how a condom works, knowing that it doesn't increase their likelihood of engaging in sexual intercourse, and may give them the confidence to use one if they do decide to engage in sexual intercourse. A discussion of safer sex practices also provides an opportunity to discuss positive limit setting for sexual behaviors. So you let them know that it's normal to have sexual feelings and that you can make responsible decisions about how to act upon them. Now, we know that less intimate behaviors, such as hand-holding, become opportunities to learn how to build trust and knowledge about one's partner, and how to navigate matters of consent and mutuality in a relationship. So, for example, young couples need to figure out when it feels right to hold hands. They need to learn to ask permission and respect one another's wishes. And then they can choose not to hold hands or kiss at times. And you may find opportunities for discussing limits and wise decisions. For example, when you're watching TV, you see a couple kissing, and you might say, you know, that couple just met, and now they're kissing, snogging or whatever, I don't know. How long do you think that you need to, that someone ought to wait before they kiss another person romantically? You know, is it appropriate to do that with someone you just met? And absolutely, Ott says, tweens need to know that they can choose to say no to any sexual behavior or social situation that makes them feel uncomfortable or that feels coercive, okay? All right. Just a brief bit about connecting our faith and sexuality education for this age range. At this stage, children are beginning to develop a sense of ownership of their faith. They're asking more questions. They're asking tough questions. And so we need to give them space to ask these questions. And stories like the prodigal son in Luke 15 or doubting Thomas in John 20 might help them feel permission to have questions and to have doubts. And it's probably worth sharing your own doubts that you've experienced in faith, too. Regarding sexuality and relationships, you can talk about some romantic relationships and friendships in the Bible. Jacob, Leah, and Rachel in Genesis 29. David and Bathsheba in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. David and Jonathan in 1 Samuel 20. Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz in Ruth chapters 1 through 4. Mary and Joseph in Matthew 1 and 2 and Luke 2. And Jesus and the disciples throughout the Gospels. And these become opportunities to talk about healthy and unhealthy relationships and friendships. And we also avoid pretending that everyone in the Bible is a good role model for good sexuality or good friendship, because it's not always the case. And then you get a chance to have some of these conversations. Let me just pause briefly, see if there's any questions or comments before we move into the high school years. What's that?
I was just asking,
who is a
healthy model for sexuality in the Bible?
Who is a healthy model for sexuality in the Bible? Good question. Anybody got an answer? One person says not many on this list.
Joseph.
Yeah, Joseph. What's that? Yeah, Joseph, good model of fidelity and respect. Joseph and Mary in the New Testament, we don't know much about Joseph in the Old Testament's relationships. Yeah, so good. All right, moving on to the high school years. A time, and I set this out to be roughly ages 14 to 18 years old. A time of egocentrism, and what I mean by that is youth are figuring out who they want to be in the world, all right? They're trying to work out this question, who am I and who will I become, all right? Thinking in terms of physical development, at the beginning of high school, teens may be in very different places. Some may not have gone through puberty. Some will appear fully developed physically. But by the end of high school, most everyone is in the same place developmentally. Secondary sex characteristics are fully developed, hormonal fluctuations are settled down into patterns, and youth will have a better sense of what they'll finally look like in an adult body. Along these lines, body image becomes a significant concern for many. Children and youth are constantly bombarded. I'm seeing folks shake their heads yes. Children and youth are constantly bombarded with media images and unrealistic cultural expectations. So this is a critical time for you as a parent to support positive body image for your children. You can do this through supportive, unsolicited comments, reminding of their intrinsic self-worth, encouraging a healthy, active lifestyle, and supporting healthy eating. Teenagers may engage in a wide variety of sexual behaviors, kissing, heavy touching, outer course, mutual masturbation, oral sex, anal sex, vaginal sex, of which I never thought I'd discuss in a church setting or record into a podcast. What is outer course? Outer course is, I actually looked this up too, and there's a little bit of a disagreement or discussion of what it is. Probably one way to put it is sex with your clothes on or sexual activity without penetration, okay? All right. And some youth will not engage in any sexual behaviors during high school. I did look up some statistics. Actually, I think these were out of OTT. The 2009 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, talking about sexual intercourse in high school, roughly 30% of ninth graders will engage in sexual intercourse, and then it increases by about 10% each year. So 40% of 10th graders, 50% of 11th graders, and almost 65% of 12th graders will have had sexual intercourse defined as penile vaginal intercourse. All right. Again, statistics are going to vary. You know, different studies come up with different numbers, but this seems to be pretty in line with the average. I'm just curious. Sterling and I were talking a little bit about this and his experience as a youth minister. How many of you, thinking back to your youth groups, were your youth groups places where teens began to experiment and try different sexual behaviors? Anybody? Maybe we were just blissfully unaware of them. What's that? Yeah, hooking up at lock-ins, yes. All right. So what does this mean for us as parents or for you as parents of teenagers? I'm still trying to figure this out, to be quite honest. Sexual activity among teenagers is a reality. Thinking about your role as a parent, teenagers absolutely need access to information about preventing pregnancy and protection from sexually transmitted infections or STIs. Even if they're not sexually active, they probably will be sooner or later, come college or marriage. Teenagers ought to be able to explain how pregnancy and reproduction work. And Beth and I know from working with teenagers that not all teenagers know this. But this knowledge results in more effective use of contraception. If a teenager does come to you about an unintended pregnancy, they need to hear from you that you accept them, that you love them, that you forgive them. And also, I think that God loves them and accepts them, too, especially if they're having feelings of guilt. And then you can support them and have a conversation about how best to proceed from there. Teenagers, next bullet point. Teenagers should also be able to explain how STIs are transmitted. The more they know, the more they're capable of making safe, informed decisions. A lot of teenagers think that you can see that if someone has an STI, there will be a visible sign of it. That's not always the case. Not all STIs manifest visible symptoms. A lot of teenagers think that STIs can only be transmitted through intercourse, and that's also not the case, not by a long shot. So they need to know about how STIs are transmitted and how to keep them safe. If teens are sexually active, I would encourage them by reminding them that safer sex practices show care and concern for both them and their partner. This is one way of showing love in this situation, by protecting each other. And, you know, it also demonstrates Christian values, even if you as a parent would really rather they didn't engage in sexual activity in the first place. And finally, teenagers are also capable of understanding the more abstract consequences related to sexual intercourse, such as emotional consequences, financial and educational ramifications if their partner or they become pregnant. So, you know, pros and cons of sexual activity, but teens often overestimate the benefits of intercourse, and then they underestimate the negative, unexpected consequences. All right. We're going to come back to premarital sex in just a little bit. Let me say just a couple more things. Most teens will experience some form of dating relationship by the end of high school, and this is really close friendships and romantic relationships can be a part of healthy emotional development. In these contexts, youth have a chance to learn to share their feelings, be vulnerable, respect, trust, and care for others, and also share decision-making as they learn to be a couple together. All right. How are we doing? Good? Okay. Everybody okay? All right. Good. All right. Let's talk three big topics that I think are worthy addressing. Premarital sex, masturbation, and sex in the media. So we're going to try to hit all three of these. So a quote to start us off on this topic. Most mothers think that to keep young people from lovemaking, it is enough not to speak of it in their presence. All right? A quote from the 17th century. So if we think this is a new issue, we're misguided. Okay? So question, and this is one that Kate Ott posed hypothetically. I don't want my child to have premarital sex. How can I make sure they don't? Lock them in a tower. Yeah, good idea. I also Googled chastity belts, and there's all sorts of great images on Wikipedia. Yeah, I was Googling a lot of stuff. I practice safe Googling practices at work today. HR, I was at seminary. All sorts of things. All right. I don't want my child to have premarital sex. How can I make sure they don't? Short answer, you can't. It's ultimately their decision to make. What you can do as a parent is to give them the best information you can, support them when they have questions or want to talk to you about making this decision, and then help create safe dating practices and contexts so that they don't feel pressured into something they don't want to do. Okay. And I do want to just keep thinking about this a little bit more, because it is such a prevalent reality in our culture. So if you think back to week 5 when we were talking, I guess that was the first week of our New Testament discussion, I said this, as best as I can gather from my reading of the texts, there's no scriptural mandate specifically against premarital sex. But what I think is evident is that there's a cultural assumption by biblical writers that marriage was the primary, though not exclusive, context of sexual activity. I talked a little bit about the gap between puberty and age of marriage by now. We know that in biblical times, you're likely to be married by the time you hit puberty or right around then. Now you're hitting puberty around 12 or 13, and then you're going to, you know, on average wait 15, 16, 17 years until you get married. So big change in context. So some trends in premarital sex. Since the 1950s, 90% of couples report engaging in sexual intercourse prior to marriage. 90%. And I cite the study, Finer Trends in Premarital Sex in the United States, 1954 to 2003. It's overwhelmingly typical, and statistics are not much different from for Christian couples. I talk to pastor friends, and they do premarital counseling, and they say many, if not most, couples that they marry are either cohabitating or already had sex. So this is increasingly the reality or norm for church-going Christian couples. And it's not a new thing in the late 20th or early 21st century, despite claims of media influence and cultural shifts. I did some digging. So if we go back to the colonial era, there's an overt disapproval of premarital sex, but privately, behind closed doors, premarital sex was often overlooked or allowed in some instances. Couples who were courting were frequently allowed to sleep in bed together. This sometimes involved bundling, where you would wrap them in sheets so that they couldn't engage in sexual intercourse. William can tell you more about this. I'm presuming he doesn't have experience with this, but knowledge from the history end of things. Sorry, there you go, blushing. But a little bit of a double standard in this era. If a couple did get pregnant, they were expected to get married. And records show that 30 to 40% of women were pregnant when they got married in the colonial era. I had a very similar reaction. I don't know what to say. This is what Goodbeer says in Courtship and Sexual Freedom in 18th Century America. Yeah, the comment is that probably means that 90% of couples were engaging in premarital sex. And I have no idea, but one does wonder about the prevalence of premarital sex even in colonial times. I also did a little bit of digging, and Kate Ott talks a little bit about this too, on purity or virginity pledges, or even abstinence until marriage education. And this is a pretty typical approach to premarital sex discussions in evangelical churches. And so I did end up reading some interesting statistics about those who pledge to wait until marriage, and you can see the stats here. So research does suggest that on average, a purity pledge or someone that takes a pledge may delay the age of sexual intercourse, but they're not necessarily more likely to delay intercourse until they're married. So interesting, they might wait longer, but not necessarily wait till they're married. One study, however, did suggest that people who make personal promises to themselves to wait are more likely to keep them, while those who make group or public pledges are less likely to keep their pledge. So if you are at a big youth rally, they're like, everyone come forward and sign the pledge, those folks are less likely to keep the pledge because it's done under, external pressure, and so they're not necessarily making up their own minds, all right? So if you think, to myself, I really want to wait until marriage, I'm more likely to wait until marriage, all right? Pledgers are less likely to use contraception or protection when they do have sex, but they're as likely or more likely to engage in oral or anal sex, perhaps in an effort to maintain virginity. And finally, some research suggests a negative impact on sex and sexuality after marriage for couples because they often promote a view that sex is dirty and they have all these messages of guilt and shame that accompany sexual behavior in this view. So, and I said I'm still wrestling with this. I have a young child. I have, 10, 15 years to figure this out. Some of you don't have that long. Some of you, this is, receded into the rearview mirror, and you're like, thank goodness I don't have to But this is important as we talk in churches about how we raise our children and youth. So a couple of thoughts come to mind. Where do you draw the line? What constitutes premarital sex? Or what is it exactly that you don't want your children to do? These studies are talking specifically about penile vaginal intercourse. But we talked about outer course earlier. You can have an orgasm with your clothes still on. We know that oral sex is prevalent among teens. And we know that most teenagers will engage in some level of sexual activity, even if it's only holding hands and kissing or touching. So I'm just kind of wondering, where do you want to draw the line? And I think this is a conversation that you can and should have with your children. I'm also thinking about David Jensen's 5 markers of ethical sex that Tracy shared in week 8. Recall their consent, mutuality, covenant and trust, community and joy. And as I wrestle with this topic, one of the reasons I like it is that he uses this language of covenant and trust, and it, in my mind, sort of reframes things from just sex within marriage. And we talked a little bit about this a couple weeks ago with some of the case studies that Tracy shared. So, you know, at least for Jensen, the question then becomes not, are you married? Do you have a piece of paper from the courthouse? But would you describe your relationship as a covenantal relationship, one of promise? And is there a high degree of trust? And I think this may allow us to have an honest conversation about ethical sexuality in the church without necessarily mandating sexual abstinence before marriage. Now, Jensen's is not an anything goes perspective. It expects and even demands honest conversations and to think seriously about the ramifications of any level of sexual activity with your partner. So whether or not you define your relationship as a covenant relationship, the answer is probably no for most high schoolers, even though they might say yes, and how it affects and intersects with the larger community. So thinking then about how you would have this sort of premarital sex conversation with your teenagers or with young adults. I think it's certainly important to talk about the risks and responsibilities that accompany sexual activity. There's good and bad, right? Increased intimacy, unless you don't want increased intimacy in your relationship. Children, unless you don't want children. Risk of STIs. Say you think you meet Jensen's 5 markers, you think you do, then are you willing to accept the possible outcomes of sexual activity with your partner? And have you talked to your partner about this? There are plenty of good reasons to wait until marriage, but I think regardless, this has to be a part of the conversation with your partner. And are you willing to accept all of the consequences, good and bad, if you do engage in sexual activity? Now, for those of you that are wondering, what does research suggest about teenagers who do choose to delay sexual intercourse? This is what Ott says. Teenagers delay sexual intercourse when they have a supportive environment, when they have open communication with parents and influential adults, when they have positive self-identity and self-esteem, pro-social activities like church, sports, and hobbies, and a sense that they have future prospects of success after high school. I assume this means like career prospects, not, you know, sexual prospects. And in a 2012 survey, 87% of teenagers said open, honest conversations with their parents could help them put off sex and avoid pregnancy. And students who take part in comprehensive sex ed programs delay having sex for the first time, have less sex and fewer partners, and rely more on contraception than their peers. I discovered that in a New York Times article called Let's Talk Frankly About Sex. All right. So it's not an either-or proposition. You can talk about waiting for sex with your high schoolers while also talking openly about contraception, STI risks, and mutual pleasure in sexual relationships, as well as what Christian values and qualities make for a healthy sexual relationship. One more thing I want to say about this. I think that the church has done a lot of damage with this. Premarital sex does not make one damaged goods. It does not ruin one's beauty as a child created and loved by God. And neither does it obviate one's ongoing need to make wise decisions about sexual activity inside or outside of marriage. All right. Some folks might feel, you know what, I'm damaged goods. That's it. I might as well just keep having sex. That's not the case. Just because you did it once doesn't mean you should keep doing it. You still have to make wise decisions. All right.
Masturbation. All right, a few quotes for you. What I like about masturbation is that you don't have to talk afterwards. Milos Forman. Masturbation, noun, an extremely disgusting act performed on a regular basis by everyone else. Robert Tefton. And masturbation is the primary sexual activity of humankind. In the 19th century, it was a disease, and the 20th, it's a cure. Thomas Sasse. All right. There's a lot of guilt and shame surrounding masturbation, and I think it's very relevant to talking to teenagers about sex, so we're going to talk about it. I'm the one that has to do all the talking, so y'all don't have to worry about anything. I'll stand up here anxiously and do my best, all right? William Yarber says, quote, "Most of us masturbate. Most of us also were raised to feel guilty about it," all right? We get this message, if it feels good, it's bad, internalized from an early age. But I would suggest just because you feel guilty or shameful about something doesn't mean it's sinful. It just means that you've internalized some messages from an early age. And not everything that feels good is bad. I should just say for the podcast and for those listening here and at home, Sterling and Tracy have no idea that I was going to say this tonight. So... all right. So let's just clarify definition. Masturbation, sexual stimulation of one's own genitals for sexual arousal or other sexual pleasure, often, though not always, to the point of orgasm. And I said, yes, I did get this definition from Wikipedia, though please don't tell my students that. Let's just talk briefly about the biblical witness about masturbation. And if you Google, is masturbation a sin, and I did this afternoon, you'll get plenty of discussion on the topic. A lot of it centers around Genesis chapter 38, verses 9 to 10. Masturbation is often referred to as the sin of Onan. Just a quick refresher. Onan is supposed to impregnate his dead brother's widow according to the laws of levirate marriage. Anybody remember this? His brother dies and leaves a widow, and he's supposed to get her pregnant according to, you know, custom and tradition and law of the period. And he pulls out at the last second. And so it says he spills his semen or spills his seed on the ground and doesn't get her pregnant. This is actually coitus interruptus, not masturbation. And Onan's failing here is a failure to fulfill the law of levirate marriage. I think it's helpful when we talk about masturbation to talk about sexual acts versus the context of sexual activity. The act of masturbation is not sinful. Are there contexts, however, in which masturbation can be said to be sinful or unhealthy? Absolutely. Certainly within the context of overwhelming lustful thoughts. Are there contexts in which masturbation can be said to be perfectly healthy? Absolutely. Must masturbation include lustful thoughts? Probably not. And as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about, is there a difference between lust and desire? You know, we've been talking a lot about the language of desire during this series and how God's desire in Scripture becomes paradigmatic for our desire. Desire is perfectly normal. I would suggest desire is different than lust. Desire stems from a view of abundance and a context of abundance, not a lack or scarcity. So what if the context is a desire for sexual pleasure and exploration of one's body? It's not a sin to desire your partner. It's not a sin to feel sexual pleasure, all right? So I ran across this question when I was Googling this afternoon. Question, my husband and I have been married over 12 years. We recently learned in a Bible study class that masturbation is a sin. This is the only way that I'm able to reach climax. So what sort of word does the church have for a woman who feels genuine sexual desire here? I would say no, I don't think it's a sin. I did dig up some statistics for y'all. It's hard to find good statistics on this because, you know, largely self-reported. I would guess that... glad you laughed at that. I would guess that the... it's the reality is that the statistics are probably on the higher end of these numbers. All right, so statistics that I found, greater than 95% of men masturbate and greater than 80% of women. All right. Even among married and long-term couples, a little bit harder to pin down, but I heard quotes of 57 to 87% of men and 37 to 77% of women. Again, I'm just going to guess that it's probably towards the higher end of the spectrum. And so, you know, I can imagine someone asking, is it normal if I masturbate and I'm married? Well, let's not use that normal or abnormal terminology. We can say that masturbation, even among married couples, is typical. So my assumption, and one of the reasons I wanted to share this section in tonight's session, is that most everybody's doing it. You all, most of you are probably doing it. Yes, even you podcast listeners. And I think that there's so much shame and guilt attached to it, and I want to try to break down some of that shame. All right? I'm doing okay. How are y'all doing? Thumbs up? Good. Thanks. So a common but flawed assumption, if someone is in a healthy sexual relationship, they would not need to masturbate. The reality is actually masturbation typically augments sexual activity in marriage rather than being a substitute for partnered sexual activity. So it's not symptomatic of a sex-starved relationship. It doesn't drain one's desire for sex. There's actually a correlation between higher rates of masturbation and higher rates of sexual activity with partners in marriage. Masturbation helps someone to know how to experience sexual pleasure better, for men how to control orgasm, for women how to achieve orgasm. I saw a 1991 study in the Journal of Sex Education suggested that women who masturbate report better marital satisfaction than those who don't. All right, probably because women are less likely to orgasm during intercourse. All right, any health effects? Not bad ones. There are maybe some positive ones. Male masturbation may increase chances of becoming pregnant by flushing out old sperm with low motility. May be good for vaginal health. All right. Anyway, kind of getting back to the point. For parents of children and youth will probably begin to explore their bodies in earnest at the onset of puberty. So what Yarbrough says is children need to understand that pleasure from self-stimulation is normal and acceptable, but they also need to know that self-stimulation is something that we do in private and something that some people are simply uncomfortable with. It's also interesting to think that this is a safe sex activity. All right, no STIs contracted. All right. I will record this segment into the podcast, so this will be Sex in the Media will be a bonus for podcast listeners. But I want to pause here and just see if there are questions or comments. All right? No shame in asking. What are we talking about next week? Tracy's going to talk about how to have hard conversations in the church or in churches. Yeah, probably specifically dealing with sex and sexuality. But we'll probably save a significant amount of time for talking a little bit more generally about some of the things that we still have on our mind too. So a lot more chance for there to be table conversations. All right. Are there things from this conversation tonight that stood out to you as particularly relevant? Or, yep. Yeah. So children and youth need to know plenty about biology and facts, but they also need to know what a good, healthy relationship, loving relationship, friendship, sexual relationship looks like. Yeah, absolutely. I think often, if they're lucky, that's modeled in their home or in other couples or adults that they respect. But absolutely, they need to know what healthy relationship looks like beyond just kind of the mechanics or, you know, yes. Yeah, good, great comment. So thinking about consent and specifically on college campuses, but also, you know, in other contexts and how it's often difficult for partners to talk about sex or the sexual activity that they will or won't engage in. Married couples, even if you wait until you get married, often really struggle to talk about sex and what you desire and what feels, you know, good or healthy or appropriate to you. That's a huge reality, is it's a struggle for most people to talk about with their partner. And so certainly modeling that by talking to our kids about it or talking about it in church, even if it is uncomfortable, is going to make us all a little bit better for it down the road when it does come time to have that conversation. And that was sort of in the back of my head, I said, I know tonight's going to be awkward. It's going to be good in the long run, okay? Yes, over here and then over here. Veil of shame around conversations. How do we convince children and youth that engaging in sexual activity with a partner is something that is very emotional and cultivates a lot of emotions, good and bad? Yeah, good. Good comment. Yeah, so it's hard. It's hard. They haven't developed to the point where every decision is going to be a good one. Yeah, so it's good to have some instruction and direction from parents, although hard to kind of say, absolutely not this behavior, because then you don't have 100% guidance all the time. One last comment. And then, yeah, so using media and stories and stuff to have those good conversations. And I will actually say a little bit about that in the bonus for podcast listeners. So thank you for that comment. Y'all did great. You made it. Podcast listeners, if you're still listening, you did great too. You made it through the end of a tough conversation. So thank you.
And for those that are here live tonight, we hope you'll become podcast listeners by going on and seeing the bonus or listening to the bonus track that we didn't get to tonight. Breathe, Art. Well done. Breathe. Good job. When Tracy Hartman and I attended the series last January that inspired what we're doing here now, we were introduced to a curriculum where parents were guiding their children through this conversation, and the first question is for you to tell your child about your first sexual experience and the vulnerability that goes with that in connecting the biology piece to the emotional connection piece. And I know that's like a hand grenade that was thrown at us. So I'm throwing it at you. But, you know, we need to be thinking about how to have a more honest conversation with our teenagers beyond the biology. And tonight we have done a great job going well beyond scratching surface. And so well done. This conversation will continue, fortunately. We've got maybe 3-4 more sessions, and then we'll wrap up. 3 more to go. And so we can hear children above our heads and in the room beside us. They're about to take the whole building over because apparently somebody made some babies, and they're all over the place here. So with that said, you baby maker people, go get your babies and have a great night, and we'll look forward to seeing you very, very soon. Blessings to you all. Good night.
Greetings, podcast listeners. This is Art, and this is our bonus session for the podcast. And so this is sex in the media and how we can deal with that, tips for children of all ages. And this information that I'm going to share comes from a website, www.commonsensemedia.org. This is a website that Kate Ott recommends in her book. And the article that I'm pulling this information from is How Much Sexual Content in Media is Appropriate for Kids. And, you know, as I'm thinking about sex in the media and the prevalence of it today, we tend to think it's a curse. But on the other hand, it can be something that could be a springboard into good conversation with your children. So it certainly provides opportunities too. All right, so a couple of tips for parents of elementary school age kids when dealing with sex in the media. So first tip for elementary school age kids, you just want to keep sexual content out of their media if possible. Young kids, we know, end up imitating what they see, and whatever they hear, they end up repeating, even if they don't understand it. So best just to try to help them avoid sexual content in the media as much as possible. And you're also going to want to turn on safe search filters on your search engines. So Google or whatever has an option for a safe search. Even if they're looking for, you know, the most innocuous thing online, sometimes images and websites pop up that are unexpected that you don't want them accessing. All right. Tips for parents of middle school age kids. First of all, be aware of and share your values. At this point, most kids will know a number of facts about sex and sexuality. But middle school is also an age where there's a lot of humor, surrounding sex and sexuality, in part because they're embarrassed about it, and in part because they're curious about it. But it's important for them to realize that these things are also serious. And so sharing our values is one way to do that. All right, number two, don't let kids use TVs and computers behind closed doors. So you want to know, to a large extent, if possible, what your children and youth are watching. And then that's going to make it easier for you to set appropriate boundaries on what they're watching. And probably an even better case scenario, watch with them and listen to what they're listening to. And so you can answer questions when they come up or ask questions of your own. Along those lines, number three, look for teachable moments. So songs that they're listening to, particular lyrics or particular incidents in TV shows or movies can become an opportunity to talk about what's happening on the screen. A lot of children aren't going to feel comfortable talking about their own sexual feelings and attractions and urges, but they might feel more comfortable discussing what's going on the screen. So, what do you think about this situation? Is this person making a wise decision? How might they make a wise decision in this context? And fourth, for middle school age children, you might consider providing a list of bookmarked websites that have accurate information about questions they may have regarding sexuality and sexual behaviors. This is a way so that they're not just kind of Googling on their own. This is a way to make their web searches safer. Okay, and a couple of tips for parents of high school age kids. Number one, you want to talk to them about the difference between scripted sex and reality. So we know in real life, sex is different than it is in the movies or on TV. But youth don't know that or may not know that at this point. So by the time they're in high school, they are moving into a sexually active age. So it's important to discuss consequences and risky behaviors that come up in movies or in TV shows that the movies or TV shows aren't going to label as risky behavior. And it's also worth just kind of reminding them, sex sells. So that's one of the reasons why it's so prevalent in media is it's going to sell products or make you want to watch a TV show. And so even just pointing out that fact might help them realize that it's unrealistic. All right. And number two, for high school age kids, it might be worth pointing out examples of safe sex in the media. So if you see characters engaging in safer sex practices in a TV show or in a movie, that sends a healthy, positive message worthy of emulation. All right. Hope this was helpful. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and blessings to you all.